I've mentioned before that C.S. Lewis once said in his classic work, Mere Christianity, that if we on earth look around and find nothing that fills or satisfies our soul, it is an indication that we were made for something else, something good, something better, something that settles us, something that calms us, and something that gives us peace and wholeness. I don't know about you, but every time I look around, I see frustration, and I see pain, and I see suffering. Don't get me wrong. I see plenty of good things, too. Things that make life worth living, things to be joyful about, and things to be happy about. But ultimately, I have not found or seen the one thing that makes me feel like I am fully complete and satisfied. I'm looking to God, but I know that right now, everything is not the way that it should be. And all around us, we see people right now suffering with COVID. Our location in the country is particularly in a rough spot. Bill Frist tweeted the other day, former senator from Tennessee, that Tennessee is number one in the nation in the rate of transmission of coronavirus. And I don't say that to beat anybody over the head and say we ought to be wearing masks or we ought to be more vaccinated. That's not my concern in making that statement. My concern is that I do see rampant illness, and I do see things that cause worry and concern. But it's not just health-related. We see people who are suffering from broken relationships. We see people who are suffering because they're in a dire financial situation. We see all kinds of pain and heartache, right down to those that are caused by the very weather that at times blesses us, but also causes curse. Everything around us reminds us that we're not living in the world that God intended us to live in when He created it. Romans chapter 8 is perhaps my favorite chapter in the Bible. In Romans chapter 8, Paul talks about the fact that creation is groaning, creation is longing to be released from the dreadful burden that's on us. This dreadful curse. That is life not being what it's supposed to be. And in chapter 8, verses 24 and 25, Paul says this. He says, hope that is seen is not hope. That is, when you look around and you see everything that's going on, don't get too comfortable with the way things that are. Because if your hope was in the middle of this, you would have no hope at all. Hope that is seen is not hope. The very nature of hope is that you are reaching out and you are longing with all of your heart for something better than the way things currently are. There is this earnest expectation that things are going to get better, that things are going to be better, but that expectation is not realized in the moment. You are wishing and longing, and that wishing and longing is not just a pie in the sky wish that might never be achieved. Hope is something that you are certain of and you are sure of, and the one thing that you know about it is that you don't have it at the moment. Hope that is seen is not hope, because who hopes for what he sees? If you could see what you hope for, hope would be realized. It would be there. And Paul says, if we do not see what we hope for, we wait patiently. We patiently wait for what God is going to do to eliminate all the trouble and the heartache and the curse. We are patiently waiting to fully realize and experience heaven. Well, what does heaven look like? Well, if we knew the answer to that question, we would be able to say that we could see our hope, right? And it wouldn't be hope. And the Bible doesn't give us a clear, that is, a detailed, certain description of heaven. There are a lot of things that we do know about it, but there's a whole lot that we don't know about it. We know that it is what is going to happen when God saves us. That's described in a whole lot of different ways. John describes it in Revelation as being a city that is coming down out of heaven so that the presence of God will be with mankind. And he describes that city as being a perfect square, almost like a perfect cube, with gates that are literally pearls. Not gates that are lined with pearls, but gates that are literally pearls, with walls of jasper and all kinds of different precious stones, with streets that are paved with gold, the very surfaces that you walk on, the most precious thing that you've ever seen in your life. And I don't know that John was intending to give us a literal picture of heaven when he wrote that, but he was searching for things that we could grasp and things that we could hold on to that would allow us to know just how precious this time or this moment is going to be compared to everything else that we have dealt with as we've lived life under the curse of sin and death. We look forward for that beautiful moment when God will come and save. But what does that salvation look like? Isaiah 35 paints a vivid picture of this kind of salvation. Let me set the stage by talking about what the prophet Isaiah wrote about and what he prophesied about in his own day and time. He prophesied to a people of God that had gone astray. People in the northern country of Israel, remember at the time that Isaiah lived, Israel was divided into two separate states. The people that made up the covenant people of God were divided into two states that were at odds with each other. Israel was to the north, and then the country of Judah to the south. And Israel, on its face and on its surface, was a whole lot more rebellious than Judah, but Judah was rebellious as well. Isaiah prophesied to that northern kingdom, and he prophesied about their idolatry and their wickedness. He prophesied about the way that they were treating their own people. He prophesied and told them that they had to change their ways, or else God was going to send his day of judgment on them, and they would be wiped out. And part of this day of judgment he described as being like grasshoppers that would come and wipe the country clean of all the vegetation. He described it as being like the great giant trees in Tyre to the north that they so depended on being felled. He described God's judgment not only on Israel, but God's judgment on other countries who troubled Israel and Judah. And he described an utter disaster. He also described the time when Israel would come back, when Judah would come back, and they would be restored to their position. But some of the things that Isaiah said in his description don't seem to have ever happened. And we wonder, did Isaiah know what he was talking about? Was he really a prophet that was truly representing God? Because although Judah came back from captivity, none of these things ever really seemed to happen, that weren't fulfilled in their fullness. Is it possible that when Isaiah talks about Israel and Judah coming back from captivity and being restored and being made whole, that he was talking about that moment as a moment to prefigure a time when all of God's people were going to be restored, when all of God's people were going to be made whole and right again, and when God was going to do for the whole world what he was planning to do for Israel itself? Isaiah was prophesying to a people who were worn out, who were tired, and who, when they thought about God's judgment and justice, they cowered because they knew they were coming under condemnation. And so in chapter 35, verse 3, Isaiah says, "Strengthen the weak hands. Make firm the feeble knees." You've got work to do with your hands. You've got to go places. You are going to need yourself to be whole. You're going to need yourself to continue on and continue going forward. And so he said, make yourself strong. Get ready to go. This is an image that the Hebrew writer would pick up on in Hebrews chapter 10. Strengthen the weak hands. Make firm the feeble knees. Have the courage to keep on going and living the way that God wants you to live. Because God is going to come and He is going to save. But let's take a look at what that salvation looks like. On why we need to keep going. Look in verse 4. Isaiah says, "Say to those who have an anxious heart." Have you ever had an anxious heart? Have you ever had a fearful heart? Have you ever had a heart that was unsettled by everything that you see going on around you, by the troubles that you face, by the troubles that you see the people who are very dear to you facing, and the general state of the welfare of our communities and our towns and of our countries and the general state of welfare in the world? Have you ever been troubled by that? Isaiah is talking to you. Say to those who have an anxious heart. Say to those who have a broken heart. Say to the people who are ready to give up, be strong. Fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance, with the recompense of God. With everybody that is troubling you, God is going to come and He is going to take care of the matter. He will come and He will save you. What does this salvation look like? Isaiah goes on to describe it in detail. He says in verses 5 and 6, first of all, the eyes of the blind shall be opened. Any of you wear prescription lenses? I do, and I have since the fifth grade. I've had eyes that don't do what they are supposed to do, what God made them to do, fully and completely. I'm not totally blind, but I will tell you that if I take my glasses off, I can't see even the details of my children's faces, and I could not identify them sitting here on the front row. You can identify with that, some of you? I remember when I first got my glasses. In the fifth grade, I didn't realize just how poorly I saw. I would make my way towards the television set. I would unconsciously try to sit closer to the chalkboard in the schoolroom because I didn't realize what kind of state that I was in and just how poorly I was seeing. Until I sat down and had my eyes tested by one of those tests that they bring into the school system. And I found out that I wasn't seeing well at all. And I remember when I sat down in the doctor's chair and, you know, like Don does, he flips the little lenses in front of you, the moment that everything cleared up. And I realized just how poorly I had seen. Some folks don't know just how badly they have it. And Isaiah said, for the blind, for the peoples whose physical eyes don't work the way that they're supposed to, God is going to come and their eyes are going to be opened. This is not a metaphor. This is a literal promise. Also in verse 6, he says, the ears of the deaf will be unstopped. Perhaps you've been riding in a car and you felt a momentary time when you're going up and you change elevation and all of a sudden you're not hearing quite as well as you were supposed to. You recognize it and then you yawn and your ears pop and you hear the sudden rush of air and it feels better. Or perhaps you've been sitting in an ENT's office and he takes a look in your ear and he uses a special device and pulls out a clump of earwax. as ugly and as nasty as that stuff is, the moment that that stuff comes out of your ear and you hear the rushing of the air go into your ear canal, you realize what you have been missing. And you realize, I have a blessing now that I didn't have before. The ears of those who are deaf, he says, will be unstopped. They will be unplugged. A literal promise from Isaiah. He says, then the lame man shall leap like a deer. Those people who are infirmed and their legs won't take them to where they are going, supposed to go. They'll be jumping up. He said, they will be springing into action. Imagine the excitement. And he says, the tongue of the mute will sing for joy. Somebody who can't talk, who cannot talk, will suddenly be expressing words of praise and shouting to God at the top of their voice. God is going to roll back every physical problem and every physical ailment that we face in this new age, he says. A literal promise from Isaiah. In verses 6 and 7, he says, for waters will break forth from the wilderness and streams in the desert. The burning sand shall become a pool and the thirsty ground springs of water. And so God is not just, he said, going to stop with humans and make humans whole. He said, God is going to make the world around you whole. In these harsh desert places, the burning sand becomes a pool of water. The thirsty ground becomes springs. And so this dry, hot, parched sand that burns your feet now becomes a cool and relaxing place. This place where there was nothing to quench your thirst now becomes a place where the springs are coming up and there is abundant water. He says also in verse 7 that the haunt of jackals, where they lie down, the grass shall become reeds and rushes. The jackals roamed the desert wilderness territory. They made their homes in the barren rocks, and they could use the places where the crags were to hide. They could use this uneven terrain as footing to mount an ambush on unsuspecting animals or people as they passed by. He said that that place is going to be made like the low-lying wetlands, full of rushes and reeds, full of papyrus. What a beautiful transformation. There will no longer be a threat. God is going to reverse the curse. You know what curse I'm talking about, right? I'm talking about Genesis 3, when Adam and Eve sinned and they tried to hide themselves in the garden and God came and he exposed their sin. What did he say? He started with the snake and said, you're cursed, you're going to crawl on your belly. And then he looked at the woman and he said, you will bear children in pain. And she said, your relationship with your husband is going to be fractured. Your desire is going to be for him, but he will rule over you. There won't be that kind of harmony and peace in your homes because of sin. And then he said to the man that the ground is cursed because of you. The earth bears the result of your sins. And he said, you'll be working by the sweat of your brow. And whereas before you had no problem tending the garden and bringing forth fruit, now the thorns and the thistles are going to await you. The ground reflects what's going on in humanity's life and humanity's rebellion. God places a curse on it all. Man didn't curse the ground. God cursed the world that he had made because of humanity's rebellion. You remember what he said to Cain after Cain had killed Abel? He said, "Your brother's blood cries from the ground." This world is, in a lot of ways, a terrible, awful, chaotic place. And it is that way because of what humanity has done and God dealing with what humanity has done. But the day is coming where we are going to be saved from all of that. Heaven is our destiny. And God is going to reverse for us and for the world everything that is going wrong. That is the promise of Isaiah 35. God is going to walk it all back. And everything that God created to be good that has been spoiled will be perfect. And so because of that, you and I have to genuinely trust that God is going to undo every wrong that has been done, that he's going to wipe the board clean, that he is going to make everything pristine and unique and whole, and that the things that trouble us are going to be removed. We have to look forward, as Paul said in Romans 8, and we have to wait in patience and be dedicated to doing his will and his work. But Isaiah is not through describing this beautiful, perfect age that is to come. Notice what he says in verse 8. He says, "A highway shall be there." What do you think of when you think of a highway? You think of long stretches of roads, right? Roads that lead off into the great wide open where there is no obstacle. A highway. There are no stoplights. There are no obstructions. There are no trees lying in the road. A highway, he says, shall be there. Notice he's going to talk about what is there and what is not there. He's previously talked about then as opposed to now. Now he's going to talk about there. And it shall be, he said, called the way of holiness. This is the way of those who are following God, the way of those who are made righteous, upright before God, the way of people who are dedicated to being consecrated and devoted to God. And he says, the unclean shall not pass over it. The unclean is a code word that they had for the Gentiles. The unclean is a code word that they had for the pagans who were living around them. And so when people who were invaders from the outside, from Aramea or Syria, from Edom, or from other countries to the north, or from Assyria to the east, or from Babylon to the east, when these folks came and invaded Israel, they said that the people who were unclean were coming upon them. Because these were the people who were not dedicated to God. These are the people who were not ritually pure. They were other. And Isaiah said, there's not going to be anyone who is unclean. There's not going to be any invader on this highway. God is going to make it a safe place. It shall belong to those who walk on the way. And he says this, even those who are fools. Even if they're fools. Even if they don't comprehend everything exactly the way they should. Even if they make mistakes. They shall not, he said, go astray. They're not going to lose their way off of this road. It is dummy proof. Even the simple-minded, he said, can follow this road. I don't know about you, but I like dummy proof directions. I like can't fail ways to get there. And that is what I've loved about having Siri. That's what I've loved about having Google Maps or other programs just say, start here, go this way, go that way. But sometimes I don't hear correctly. Sometimes I look at the little screen and the dot shows me getting closer and closer to my destination, and then I look up and I've already passed it. And I found out that I wasn't reading correctly. I wasn't understanding correctly what the map program was trying to tell me in the moment. You've ever been there? You've done that? You know? Even the simple-minded can follow these directions, Isaiah said. There's not going to be any chance that something's going to be going wrong when you're following this highway. And then he says in verse 9, there is no lion there, nor shall there be any ravenous beast to come up. They shall not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there. There's no threat. There's nobody that's going to trouble you as you're on this road. There is no chance that you are going to be destroyed when you are walking this highway in that place. The redeemed, he said, shall walk there. Those who have been brought back. To redeem means you purchase something and you bring it back to yourself. God has purchased his people and he has brought them back to himself. He's purchased them from their ways of sin and futility and from being a part of the chaos that is in this world. And those are the people that he says are going to be on that road. What Isaiah is trying to tell us is that there will be nothing in heaven, that absolutely nothing that hinders our access to God. If you want to be close to God, and presumably you do, if you're trying to live for him and you anticipate being with him in eternity, at that point in time and in that place, there will be nothing that can keep you from him. There are all kinds of obstacles that are getting in our way in the present. All kinds of chaotic things. All kinds of evil. All kinds of temptation that we are subject to. But he said at that point, at that time, there is nothing that is going to hinder your access. There is a highway without any obstacles that's going straight to him. And you and I will be with him forever. I've had people to ask me the question, how do you know when you go to heaven that you won't ever sin and that you won't ever be cast out? Because God has promised that I won't. I've spent my whole life on earth trying to get closer to him. Hope has not been realized. And when faith and hope become sight and you grab onto it, there's no way you're going to let it go. There is not going to be any temptation. There's not going to be any obstacle. It's just going to be you and the redeemed of the Lord living in his gracious presence forever and ever and ever. I am so ready for that. Aren't you? The last thing that Isaiah says about this age and this time is in verse 10. He says, and the ransomed of the Lord. You hear ransom, think redeemed, think bought back. The ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with what? With singing. I'm going back to the city of God, singing with all my heart. Everlasting joy shall be on their heads. They shall obtain gladness and joy and sorrow, and sighing shall flee away. I am obtaining gladness and joy. I'm singing at the top of my lungs. I am going to be happier then than I ever could possibly be at any other moment in my existence. Sorrow and sighing shall flee away. Those things are going to be nowhere in the picture. I'm reminded of what John said in Revelation about there being no trouble, no trials in heaven, and God wiping away every single tear. Nothing can cause you pain or heartache in that place because the joy and the peace is going to be overwhelming. There's going to be joy and peace such that you have never experienced in this world of pain and heartache and chaos. Joy, unfettered gladness, and peace. The Hebrew idea of peace is so essential to them because they think of peace not as being the absence of conflict, but they think of being of peace as being a fulfilled state of being where everything is the way God intended and created it to be. I am whole. Joy and peace that we have never experienced. And so when you think about eternity with God, when you think about the dwelling of God being with men, as Revelation chapter 20 through 22 puts it, when you think of heaven itself and being a part of the place that exclusively right now belongs to God, how do you relate to that? And how do you relate it to the people around you who need this idea to hang on to and hold on to more than anything else that they need in life? What was it that Isaiah said in verse 4? The very first line that he said in the text that we looked at, "Say to those who are anxious." Say to those who have broken hearts, "Be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance, with the recompense of God. He will come and will save you." The idea of heaven is not something that's meant to be contained in you and not shared with anybody else. The idea of heaven is not something that is meant to be contained in a church building, or it's not meant to be contained in 10,000 church buildings or millions of church buildings across the world. It is meant to be out there amongst a populace of people who are hurting and who need to hear this message. And so the question that you and I have to answer is, while we are waiting for this hope to be realized, how will we relate it to those who desperately need to hear it? Heaven is not something that you are meant to just simply wait for. Heaven is something that you are intended to be reaching for and longing for with all of your heart. And if at some point in time God is going to make everything right that has been wrong, including you and the rest of creation, you ought to be working to bring that health to humanity and to the rest of the world in the here and now. Heaven is not just about escaping to the there and then someday. Heaven is about God's will being done on earth right now, just as it is done fully and completely in that realm that is hidden to our eyes at the moment. May we do everything that we can to help ease pain and heartache and suffering in the moment, and give this idea of hope, a hope that other people were meant to share in, to those who are around us. They need to hear the message of the gospel. They need to hear that Jesus intends for them to live a different way than they're currently living. They need to hear about baptism and consecration and devotion to God and living a life of holiness, a life that is characterized by the very heaven that was intended to fill their soul and be a destiny for them one day. May you and I do everything we can to help make that reality a part of their lives. May we pray.